My mother and father both are dead. My sister's in some far distant land.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Roundtable. It is Thursday, the 17th of June. I'll let you in on a little secret, and she'll hate me for it, but it's my wife's birthday. So happy birthday, Kelly.
Kelly.
So happy birthday to her, and you know, what's there to say other than she's the best, and I wish her a very, very happy birthday.
By the way, husbands always say she's the best, but I'm telling you, she is the best. She's wonderful.
She really is, and I'm really very, very lucky. And the only thing that I am doing to violate all of this is to say happy birthday to her because I know she just hates it.
Well, anyway, you know, I face the same thing, but in the end, I have the sneaking suspicion that they don't really hate it, but that they say they hate it.
I don't know.
No, don't say they. There's.
We're talking about wives.
It just doesn't. It sounds objectifying.
Everything sounds objectifying.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You know, you just asked this question. I didn't have a chance to ask you, but first of all, welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. We have Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Vericarious Kelly, Dorsey of Clears is on the phone. We'll get to formal introductions in just a second. I was I left my dear wife this morning. So our dog got fixed last week. Got neutered, as they say. A male dog gets neutered. And so you have to have that dreaded cone on for a week with, you know, the cone that goes around.
But the
Elizabethan
didn't.
Collar, as they call it. And Tully, the one-year-old yellow lab, is running around. And it's just, he just runs into things. And the thing looked, after a week, was just destroyed. It was just cracked, destroyed. So triumphantly, yesterday, we took the thing off. After a week, you're allowed to take the thing off. We took the thing off, and he immediately went right to the surgical site and just started to go at his stitches scab and everything. Okay, so the cone's back on. So I call the vet, and I say, well, what do we need to do to help the dog? And so now, and this is why I love my wife so much, so she told me what we needed to do. So I was describing this to my wife this morning as to what she needed to do in my absence. And that is, you take green tea bags, and then do you see where this is going yet? You take the green tea bags, and then you let them cool off a little bit. And then you use them as a compress on the surgical site. So I left my wife with green tea bags as she was dabbing my dog's former testicles, and that's the...
And why green tea?
Apparently it's some sort of astringent. I don't know.
It's just keeping in mind for myself if there is...
Yeah, if you're ever licking your surgical site, sure.
Oh, my
God. Well, and that's been my day. So good morning, everyone. Welcome. I hope you're having a good time.
You don't get this information on AM radio.
No, you really don't. Anyway, I welcome you all. Let's get into it. Alan Chartok is here. He's in the studio. Good morning. How are you?
Hello.
Good to see you. Good to
How'd
have you
do?
Here.
How'd you do?
Albany's Chief City Auditor Dorsey Appleers is with us. Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Happy birthday, Kelly. And I'll just say those green tea bags also work if you happen to get a sty on your eye.
Wow. Oh, wow. Ooh. That's good. Excellent. Yeah, I bet Tully would prefer a sty. thank you. That's good.
So you're going to get out there, Madam Auditor, and find some major wrongdoing today?
No more than any other day, right, Dorsey?
Exactly.
Yeah. Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is in the house. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Joe. Good to be back.
Good to have you here. And Vericarious Kelly, Siena College professor of comparative politics. Good morning. How are you?
I'm excellent, and we can all tell we're back in the studio, can we?
Yeah, it feels good. It's very nice to have everyone back, and we welcome you. I'll say this for the 180th time, but we're all vaccinated, and we're ready. And I don't know. Does that even count anymore? Or all of those restrictions, I guess, have been dropped? So it counts to us, but I don't.
You know, Vera, I've been wanting to ask you this question all week because you are our comparativist.
Oh,
as
boy,
we say.
Here we go.
Right off the bat.
And we have, you know, President Biden meeting with all of the major people in, you know, the European democracies.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me, although I have no idea if I'm right, that the lead was taken by the Frenchman. Is that right, do you think, or do you think...
Emmanuel Macron.
Yes.
So, yeah, in some part it is, as a spokesperson sort of for powerful European countries, because Angela Merkel is outgoing as a chancellor.
And outgoing also, means she's going out.
She's completing.
More outgoing.
Yeah, she's
outgoing as in...
Well, she's outgoing and she's not dead.
Not gregarious.
Her personality is not outgoing, but she will be completing her term fairly soon, and so she's not projecting the kind of power that
leadership.
She used
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
And also you have to remember Ursula von der Leyen is now heading the European Union, and she's a German. So that also sends a larger message. Whoever leads, you know, on this rotating position is also representing, in essence, you know, although it's the entire European Union, she's also a very well-known German official.
Ursula
von der Leyen.
Von der Leyen.
She was the former defense minister in Germany.
Well, of course. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
So what is the... We knew that, of course.
Well, of course.
And I'm sorry, the heir apparent to Angela Merkel?
No, she's just heading the European Union,
okay,
and she's a German official, a well-known... You know, member of the Christian Conservative Party. So, in essence, Germany is always visible through Ursula von der Leyen's.
Gotcha.
I'll be walking around all day long muttering Ursula von der Leyen.
It's quite a name. I know you've pronounced it really well, and I think you've done, you know, an excellent job with that. But
thank
so
you for that.
Sometimes I think these arrangements are because Germany does not want to come across as dominating Europe, so that's one of those things. We don't want that. We've had that, right? Yeah, well, especially
that
comment.
Yeah,
So I think the French are often stepping forward now that you can only, you know, you can't say much about the Brits anymore.
Yeah, so first of all, I want to invite our listeners to join in on the conversation, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. Of course, we always welcome your contributions, and they are mighty, so we thank you. So let's talk about the summit that took place yesterday, where President Biden and Vladimir Putin aired differences at this summit, but agreed on little. President Biden said he pressed Russian President Vladimir Putin over alleged hacking, human rights abuses, and other troubling issues in a historic first summit in Geneva on Wednesday, a session shadowed by the unprecedented deference to the canny Russian leader that President Donald Trump displayed for 4 years. The meetings, spanning only a few hours in the Swiss lakeside city known as the Capital of Peace, were too short to allow for much more than an accounting of both sides' complaints. Biden and Putin declared the event a success, mostly for their having met at all at a time when relations between the world's two greatest nuclear powers are at a post-Cold War low. Biden told reporters, "I did what I came to do," as he sought to claim the moral high ground and further an argument about the superiority of the democratic values that he has made throughout his first foreign trip as President of the United States. Alan.
Well, I think that's right, Joe. What you've just said is right. There is I have a sense that both men did fine. They both got what they wanted. There was a certain amount of recognition for Putin and, a certain cleaning up of his act internationally. And Biden, of course, is the man who called the event, showed the American people that he's willing to talk, which he should be. And I think that they had a lot of respect for him. You know, on this panel, we've had some discussion about whether he should or whether he shouldn't. I've thought from the very beginning he was the grown-up in the room, and he showed it well, and he showed it yesterday. So I was all for it.
Well, I am in the belief that any meeting such as this, whether it's politics, whether it's a labor negotiation, anytime there's a private meeting, the only people who know really what happened in the meeting are those who were in the meeting. And what we get as a result after the meeting is the what happened in the meeting according to the point of view of the person who is describing it, which leaves the rest of us to basically be speculating. I'll speculate. I agree with that, Alan. I think Biden did well from what we know. I think it was important that they have the meeting and all of the rest. On the other hand, if I want to find look for something negative, I'd say, well, they, you know, they thought that they had blocked out 4 or 5 hours for these meetings, for this meeting, and they only met for almost 3 hours.
Big deal.
Well, I'm not sure that that's a favorable sign. I'm not sure that that doesn't mean that there was a personal connection or an interaction or a very deep discussion of any of these issues as opposed to just a laundry list. So I'm not unhappy that they had the meeting. All I'm just cautioning is if you're watching the coverage and you're listening to and reading the analysis, nobody knows what happened in that meeting except the people who were there.
And by the way, I'm sorry, I know you got to go, but I want to make it real quick. And that is, I was extremely disappointed. I turned on CNN yesterday, and I was able to watch Biden give his analysis, but not Putin. You know, Putin was talking in the background. They were talking over him. I think the American people are smart enough to have listened to Putin as well as to Biden, and it got me annoyed.
So I would say the outcome is the following. Number one, both Russia and the U.S. will have ambassadors in each other's capitals again. Major step forward, because without staff and ambassadorial positions in each other's countries, you can't really speak on detailed issues. Number two, Biden brought an entire team into the meeting, which was tradition to have State Department officials surrounding you in such meetings, which was abandoned by Trump and was a very poor message to the State Department and to the diplomatic corps, and also dangerous. You remember possibly that Trump, at the last meeting he had with Putin, he demanded the notes from the translator or the interpreter, which was also not a good sign. So we really don't know anything that took place in that meeting. But these meetings are all on record. Once again, they have experts in the room. They can, look at past patterns and go forward in terms of implementing detailed meetings in the future. This summit was exactly what it promised. The two leaders are meeting. They're speaking to each other. Neither one said, I will look deeply in your eyes and trust your soul, which was apparently a pattern in the last decade or so.
A Bushian thing.
Right. So they both know they have to deliver for their countries, for their citizens, especially on security issues, especially on cybersecurity, on human rights. And they obviously know each other, Biden and Putin, and they don't really like each other. And that's fine, because they both said, we're focused on our national interests and we are going to deliver.
But don't you think there's a big difference between national interest and Putin interest and Biden interest? In other words,
totally different interests.
In other words, well, I'm not even talking about what's good for the country. It's that what's good for Putin is good for Putin. I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the man is clearly an authoritarian. Some people call him a dictator, right? An elected, re-elected dictator. But, you know, he represses dissent. He has Navalny and others in prison. He extended the prison sentences. He crushes anybody who expresses an oppositional view, be it on economic policy, social policies, or foreign policy. He constantly uses his military to threaten neighbors. I mean, this is a reality, and Biden knows it, Putin knows it, and now they're feeling each other out. And I'm just glad they're not relying on, you know, I like the man. He seems like a good guy. I mean, what is that? That's not foreign policy.
And
this
Trump
is just ridiculous.
And Trump was very suspect about his relationship with Putin. Yeah, he demanded the notes, but yeah, he didn't let anybody else in the room.
No. Dorsey, your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'll, you know, reinforce some points that have been made, but to the point about the naivete of Trump, and I think that Putin walked into this meeting knowing that this was a very different player. There was no business interest. Biden is very clear about his stance. He is there with America's best interest at heart, and he, from historical context, understands the complexity of Putin. And so it's not a very surface level analysis of who this person is based on what he says, but he has the foreign relations experience to know, based on Putin's actions, that he's a very complicated and can be a very dangerous man. But given that, both are very seasoned politicians. I think they knew walking in what to expect. The relationship between America and Russia has been very complicated. And as I mentioned, I think Putin, it's even more complicated. And so it's a very delicate balance. Putin has been, I thought it was interesting in my own analysis of things, that he has been in power as America has transitioned through five different presidents. And I think there's benefit to that. He's been in consistent power as we transition through multiple presidents with different ideologies, different ways of ruling. And so I think that gives him some leg up in terms of the dynamics between Russia and America. Some felt that the outcome of the meeting was positive for the mere fact it was a starting place. And as was mentioned, both ambassadors are back to their posts. But I thought it was interesting that one of the national commentators pointed out that the Putin pulled their ambassador from America first. And so this was really Putin circling back to now give his ambassador the green light to come back to America. And so we see the same on our side.
I do have I do have to pause you because we just have to take a break. But when we come back, okay. I'll let you finish your thoughts. So hold on to it. Don't let it go. And okay. We'll come back and then we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Dorcia Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org.
She loaned you from a building. Then she let you fall. Just to watch you drop slowly, while she's scared of it all.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is 35 minutes past 9 o'clock on the 17th day of June. Dorcy, I interrupted you. We had to go to a break. Please continue.
That's okay. And you did it so nicely, so I appreciate you. The last point that I'll make, who knew I would have so much to say on this topic, is a very interesting one. I think the last point I'll make is from the American and of course I can't speak for all Americans, but I think from the American context, I'll say I personally feel we have the right person behind the wheel in this moment, because Biden is very optimistic, yet very practical. He's diplomatic, yet no nonsense. And I think that will serve us well as we navigate the next several years dealing with a leader like Putin. And so there's still so much to be seen in the coming years.
On that note, Dorcy, I thought it was so interesting, too, that Putin was trying to stir it up by saying, you know, don't critique our domestic situation here in Russia in terms of, you know, silencing dissent. And he looked at Biden and talked about how in America, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement rose, and that is equal to the situation in Russia and the imprisonment. And so that there was no, of course, larger context to the conversation, but it was very sort of, talking point, police kill your people and you have entire groups of populations that have to rise up to be recognized in this democracy. So that was sort of Putin's pushback against any critique on, you know, imprisoning and torturing and even ordering the official state killing of,
But that's his
dissidents.
MO. I mean, that's right. What he's been doing in all of the interviews for years.
Absolutely.
And years and years. On the other hand, we have the brazenness and the lying of the United States Republican Party leadership,
yes,
which is denouncing and their followers and the media on the right side media, denouncing Trump for elevating Putin or for being there or for being weak. You name it. I'm not going to repeat the litany. Coming right off of the fact that Trump genuflected in front of Putin, did all of the things that Trump did went without criticism. And today we hear Lindsey Graham, among others, denouncing Biden for not getting anything out of Putin. It's just brazen is the only word that comes to my mind, and it's just a damn aggravating to hear it.
Well, it's an overlap between what Republican agendas are and what Putin's agendas are.
Now, what is the Republican agenda? To side with authoritarianism and Putin?
Apparently so, because that's the domestic affairs, too. I mean, domestically, the suppression of the vote.
Isn't that scary?
Along the same pattern?
It's frightening.
It is frightening. Absolutely.
Now, can I ask a question of you guys? Because I don't know the answer. I read a story that said that high among the list, if not the highest at the summit, was the ransomware attacks. And one story said that Putin was given a list of, I think, 17 segments of the ransomware world that were off limits. Mm-hmm. Don't even mess with any of these 17 or you're going to hear from us. Does that mean that whatever else was not on the list is okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, don't forget the United States does the same to other countries, right?
That's a game that's happening
everywhere.
Well, that's what Putin says, and let's say that's a given.
Yeah.
But I'm saying there are these 17 things that they're not supposed to admit. There's lots of other things that they may be the most important 17.
But also, yeah, but doesn't that then make the 17 more attractive to infiltrate?
At all sides, it seems to me the point to Biden, to Putin, is don't screw around with us in cyberspace, period. Not limiting it, not just here, but everywhere.
This list emphasizes danger zones. For example, if Russia decides to meddle with our food or clean water supply, this is very serious.
So
these are points that were specifically highlighted.
Number 18?
If you overstep those areas, there will be immediate consequences.
Well, I want to go back to the 2,000-year-old man, if I may.
Oh, please.
And their wisdom. Don't throw this rock at me or I'll throw this rock at you. And that is that's rock talk. And that is exactly what was happening yesterday. Because, interestingly, we were hearing from Biden, if you proceed with this, we know how to get at you. Now, one wonders why they weren't doing that in the first place. You know, if we know that the Russians are behind this and they're doing it, how come he has to wait to throw the rock, to threaten to throw the rock, rather than to just throw it?
Well, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
I'm still
not sure what the answer to my question is. If there were 17 areas, the most important 17, does that mean we're going to look the other way if he hits number 18?
That's not what that means.
What does this mean?
A diplomatic talk for you overstep the boundaries and we catch you doing it and you pretend it's criminal enterprises that you have nothing to do with. You are going to be held responsible, you and your leadership, you and your government,
for the 17 areas.
Immediately. Even if some supposed criminal enterprise, independent of the government, which doesn't really happen,
that, and I agree with you. That's what he said. I'm still not sure what happens if I'm number 21. That maybe number 21 is maybe number 21 is something that I'm involved with.
Oh, you're breathing a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Just a trivia.
And if I can respond to that, I agree with the notion that Biden was being very clear. These are the rules of engagement here. These are off limits, and so. For example, this whole notion, you tend to, in war, children, women, there's certain factors that I think parties can mutually agree that these are off limits, with the understanding that sometimes things can't be avoided. But there are some circumstances. So, for example, that whatever fell off that list, those issues will be explored in the event there's a problem, in the event Russia meddles, which they have been doing all along. I think it's more so Biden being very clear and speaking the language that if you touch these very critical resources, because these resources can cripple our country. And so if you touch these very critical resources, we will have a problem. And so I agree with that notion, that it was making it very clear what are the parameters here.
We do have a couple of letters from listeners. Let's go to those, and then we'll move on to other topics after our break in just a few moments. Kathleen writes, I always thought that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were entirely morally bankrupt, and I was not sure about Mitt Romney. But if they do not speak out now against Trump and his corrupt connection to Putin and come out against Putin, they are on the side of Trump and against American democracy. Tom writes, do not parse Biden's meaning too much. The absolute most important aspect of it was that America now has a normal and competent person at the helm. Harleen says China has twice the population of Russia and going to be soon the world's number one economy. Russia's economy is doing poorly. It's obvious to anybody who understands international relations that China can be a problem for Russia. Biden has already said China is a problem for the United States. Biden must have raised this to Putin. Anything on that?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, this is a very serious topic. We are trying to engage in terms of the United States and the Europeans with Russia to sort of figure out an arrangement so we don't have to deal with an increasingly complicated Russian context, when in fact we all need to be prepared to respond specifically economically with what's happening in China. That is why, for example, this morning the announcement came that the airline industries in Europe and the United States have come to an agreement. They have settled their disputes because they're afraid of what's coming from the Chinese in terms of their air industry development. That's where the competition will come from in the next 10 years. So Airbus and Boeing have come together. After 20 years of fighting it out, they also sat down during the G7 and came up with an agreement. This is in response exactly of what is emerging out of the Chinese economic context.
So why wasn't China the first summit meeting instead of Russia?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think the China summit meeting needs to be prepared in much more detail in terms of identifying what the U.S. wants. I think that's why Biden brought the entire team to Putin, and they will have an even bigger team, you know, meeting up with China, because that is nothing really happens in these major summits except photo ops, quick conversations. These are the key points that we need to discuss. And then the teams, the technocrats, the technical teams come in and hammer out all of the details. And that takes weeks and months.
Well, China really is a big problem as an economic competitor, but not only an economic competitor, but also a client of the United States. At the one time, they're setting up islands in the South China Sea, and on the other, we're sending our business to them, and we're depending on them to do all of the manufacturing that is so important to us. I think your question was very good about why not China. Well, because in the case of Russia, who cares? In the case of China, it really could be a major, because they have a lot of right on their side. Okay, well, then we're not going to do all your manufacturing for you, or we're not going to do this or that. That's very important.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
With half-damp eyes, I stared into the room.
Just a note, we're playing music this morning from artists performing at Clearwater's Great Hudson River Revival, which is happening online and virtually on June 19th, so 2 days from now. You can find out more information about the entire festival by going to clearwaterfestival.org, clearwaterfestival.org, and they'll tell you the schedule and the information
always
and all the cool stuff.
Always a great event.
Great time. Our own Wanda Fisher emceeing some of the the show there. So all of that going on, clearwaterfestival.org. Okay, let us go to other stories if we can, and we certainly can't we?
So can, we'll can.
So we talk about inflation, and the Fed estimates inflation will grow faster than projected just 3 months ago and moves up expectations for a rate hike. Latest projections come as central bank wrestles with when to pull back on its support for financial markets. The Federal Reserve expects inflation will climb to 3.4% this year, higher than the central bank's previous forecast, while also projecting for the first time that there could be two interest rate hikes in 2023. The predictions released Wednesday after the Fed's two-day policy meeting depict a delicate but mostly upbeat narrative of where central bankers think the economy is headed, as well as a serious revamp of predictions from just 3 months earlier. In March, the Fed predicted inflation would be 2.4% for this year. Moreover, earlier Fed estimates did not project an initial interest rate hike until 2024. Alan.
Well, I just remember that when Roselle and I bought our first house, 50 years ago, in Alford, Massachusetts, and we had to beg for a mortgage. And the mortgage rate was 13%. 13%, it would seem like not doable. They would hang people for that. So, that doesn't happen anymore. Now, look, we've been having it pretty good, and there are going to be interest raises, no question in my mind, and it will bring out the appropriate amount of yelling, screaming, and anger from the critics of the Democratic administration.
Here is the New York Times take on this. Their simple way of understanding the recent rise in inflation: as the pandemic is receding in the U.S. That's their, by the way, their qualifier that it's the simple way of explaining this. As the pandemic is receding in the U.S., demand for goods and services is rebounding more quickly than the supply of those same goods and services. And when demand outpaces supply, prices rise. The demand part of the story is fairly obvious. More Americans are shopping in stores, eating in restaurants, and planning vacations. They are spending some of the savings that they accumulated during the pandemic, including money from the government stimulus checks. Supply, however, is not back. The pandemic disrupted supply chains for many items, including computer chips, paint, lumber, and sneakers. It also disrupted work habits, and not everyone can or wants to return immediately to their old jobs. What did they just say this morning?
Yeah.
40% of people that are interested in resigning from the jobs they currently have.
Yeah.
I say to you, Alan, I'm not one of them. Just wanted you to know that. Okay.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. Please don't resign.
On that note, I've actually had a number of conversations with former students that graduated from Siena or students that are on the job market now. And the conversations I have are so interesting. They're talking about, if this position that I have is not satisfying me, I will look for a new position. I don't really feel strongly about going back to the office and interacting with my same old colleagues because, at a distance they were fine, but I really don't want to spend time
with
them.
Who's speaking now? You or the students?
My students. Oh, yeah, my former students and my students. This is the kind of commentary I get. So a lot of movement and bounciness is in the market because they are looking for more fulfilling and meaningful positions. That is a marked change from the past. So they are willing to wait a little longer. They're willing to jump around more. Some of the former students I've had are sort of saying, I used to think I have to stick with the job for a year before I jump. No, 2 months of experience here, and it's not the environment I see myself in, or I don't really like my boss or coworker. I'm going to move on. So that's what I call bounciness.
But Vera, right now, anybody could get jobs. There isn't a store in Great Barrington that doesn't have a help wanted.
That's not a job that they want.
Well,
that's what
job,
I mean.
No. That's a job that somebody wants. That's a
maybe.
Job. Or
that
wanted.
Is, that is maybe
well,
a job.
Wanted, yeah.
Maybe that is a job that somebody wants but cannot take because they have other responsibilities. There are children in the house that need to be taken care of. And the federal government does not support.
What, they didn't have children in the house before?
But they might not have schools open, kindergartens open, the same support. And you know what? That's what I mean that Europeans are doing. They're providing assistance to families and single moms that need help with children. They're providing payments so that the kindergarten fees or the babysitting fees aren't so high. So there's a huge discrepancy between what people need to get back into the workforce and what the reality looks like. I'm sorry, just because I see a sign in stores that they want somebody doesn't mean the pay is good, doesn't mean they have health insurance, doesn't mean that's the kind of job people want or can take because of the hours. These are very serious considerations, and we have to look at reorganizing the economic market.
But I have a question for
you.
Far be it from me to... Far be it for me to critique what you've just said, but didn't people have children before the panic? Didn't people have children at home? I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, but not schools closed and.
Now they're open.
Not all. Nope.
Yeah, well, they're going to open. Are you going to give us the same line? It's a good line, of course, that we ought to be doing more for families and everything. Mm-hmm. Are you going to say that after the schools are all open? Are you going to still say, well, you know, they're not good enough jobs and all the rest?
So I'm going to call on Dorsey to see what Dorsey has to say on that. Because I have an opinion on that.
Just like
I articulated
a professor,
I'm going to call on Dorsey to see what you have to say on that.
Dorsey goes to work.
Yes, she does.
I'm thankful and blessed to have a job and a career, actually, and a job that I love. But what I'll say there is that I think that element was there pre-COVID when it comes to the generation, the new generation in terms of, you know, I remember growing up, my mother would always say, and I grew up in D.C., get you a good government job. That was what she was told. You get you a good government job, you stay in the government, and you work it, and you retire. And that, you know, gone are the days where people are graduating from college and saying, I'm looking for a good government. And some people still are. But, mm-hmm. you know, this notion that the best thing since sliced bread is a good government mm-hmm. job, and I'm going to stay in for my pension. And so we saw pre-COVID that people tend to stay in jobs 3 years and then they're off to the next. I think that this pandemic has, you know, really accelerated this thought that, you know what, I can find a job and I don't have to live in the same place where the headquarters is located. I could actually be flexible and find a job that meets my needs. I can work from home. And so I think in addition to this different mindset about what it means to work, and also the type of work that I want to do, there are employers now who understand they can be more nimble and offer 100% remote positions to people anywhere in the country. I think the other piece of the pandemic that some people overlook is this notion that people have a different mindset of what it means to give up their time and willing to, I'm not going to stress out if I don't have to. I want to find a work environment in which there's flexibility, I'm not stressed, my values closely align with the employer's values, and I'm doing mission-driven work. And I've been hearing a lot of my own colleagues and peers who have been saying that. And the last point on this topic I'll make is that for my peers and colleagues of color, very interesting conversation playing out, you know, in the wake of George Floyd and all of the racial unrest, many have been saying, and as people are increasing the amount of diversity and inclusion and equity staff that they have on as part of their workforce, but many of my colleagues and friends of color are saying, you know what, I am interested in starting my own because right. I don't want to be in work environments in which I'm not valued. I am the only one, and I have to speak on all issues of race. It's stressful. It's traumatizing. And so I'm just going to – we're in a market where I can create my own. And so I think that's a very interesting dynamic to this the situation that we're in now.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. I see that as well in terms of entrepreneurship is up. It really matters to find a position that whether values match up. I have a number of students of color who are going back for graduate degrees that are, you know, they're now thinking this is the time. They're also tremendously heated discussions about how much debt people want to take on for the future. These are very interesting factors that might just completely reshape how we live and how we do business and how employers treat their employees.
Do your students have to come back to class?
Oh, yes. In the fall, we're completely in person.
And your professors have to come back to
class? Yes. Everybody has to be vaccinated. Employees, faculty, students.
I'm all for it. Good for you.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Dorcia Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We will be right back after this.
She run from New York City. Run right by my baby's door.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Dorcia Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Akarios-Kelly. We welcome your letters as always, panel at WAMC.org.
Well, Joe, if I may, I just want to say very quickly that I can't figure out why my coffee keeps getting so cold. And then I realized it keeps getting so cold because it's 3 degrees in here.
Well, I had to request a special jacket
and
to make it
room.
Yeah, you're okay.
Well, Joe is following the time-honored tradition of David Letterman, who kept his studio cold to keep the comedy fresh.
That's right. You keep it fresh.
Can I just weigh in briefly on the topic we were talking about before the break? The economy and interest rates, as Jackie Mason would say, is not my field. But I think, just to capitalize,
he's still alive, right?
Yeah, 93.
Jesus.
One of the funniest men who ever lived.
Yeah.
But to put in context again what I think everybody was saying, and I'll maybe say it a different way, is that for all of the things that this pandemic did to this country and the world, and has fortunately now waning and it's not as bad as it was, we're not out of the woods. The economy is a part of this pandemic impact that could take a couple of years or more to straighten out. For the instances that Vera cited about people rethinking about what they want to do, or what Dorcia was saying, I guess this is a short way of me saying, and I don't know if this came up yesterday, Joe, because I didn't hear the entire program.
Oh, you missed the good part.
Well, then this was, and I'm going to bet that I'm reemphasizing that it was premature and unseemly to have fireworks heralding the end of the pandemic when the pandemic is not ending and it's going to be with us for a while in one form or another.
Yeah, we did touch on that.
And we did.
And we felt, just as you did, that it seemed very unfortunate, especially with the loss of life. It coming
600,000 people.
Yeah. I know.
600,000 people died in this
number.
Country. As a result,
it's a horrendous
COVID.
Loss.
And,
and
one must wonder whether Andrew Cuomo wanted to distract the public. Yes, distract.
Well, and that
was
Chris Churchill's take on it.
On
bread and circus.
On the other hand, after World War II, there were plenty of fireworks and plenty of people celebrating, and we lost hundreds of thousands of people there,
too. But we won a war. This war is not over yet. It's largely over, we think, but it's not all over.
Okay, Ira, I can see.
Especially, when you look at some of the southern states where a fair number of people did not accept the vaccine,
yes.
You know, we worry about what's going to happen once people after the summer go back indoors.
I see a point.
You know, that could
also
be a problem.
Also, if the people who saw the fireworks will say, okay, well, I don't have to worry anymore because they already put the fireworks out.
Personally, I have to say, even though, I don't wear a mask practically anywhere, but I still do put a mask on when I enter a supermarket, for example, or
sure.
a larger
well,
facility.
Or a
I just don't
or...
feel comfortable when I don't really
I
know people around me. And maybe this is the new world out there of not trusting all your, you know, co-residence. And
well, you're as safe in the studio as you are in a supermarket if you've been vaccinated, so I don't have a problem with that.
But we don't know who's vaccinated in a supermarket.
No, but it doesn't matter as long as you are.
And I also want to know how long my vaccine lasts.
Exactly.
I also want to know how long my vaccine lasts.
Exactly.
You know, I noticed, and I'd be curious if you have the same experience, on my Excelsior pass, it expires in August.
Yes.
Which would
but
be
everyone had rolling dates.
Rolling,
depending
but,
on
so roughly 6 months.
Well, yeah.
Well, but that's not what the scientific evidence shows. They,
no,
so
it doesn't.
Far, we don't have clarity
don't
on that. We know 8 months to 1 year. Also,
we don't know that.
We suspect that.
But people aren't really dying in the numbers you have to have to prove this.
And also, people like me, I take immunosuppressant medications. So I wear masks when I go into large facilities.
You have to
be careful.
And let's remember that the Chinese have been wearing masks for years, way before the pandemic. So there is, and we have almost no flu in the United States this year. So there's got to be some positive things
Absolutely.
That we've learned about wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. And the Lone Ranger
agree with that, Alan.
You do? Yes.
Yeah. The Lone Ranger never got sick, and he wore a mask all the time.
So, Darcy, you were saying?
I agree with you, and as a public health professional, you know, to see how we were able to be successful with this flu season in comparison to others, these are practices that we should have been maintaining before COVID, washing hands, promoting hand washing, having hand sanitizing stations everywhere you go.
Wearing masks?
If you're sick, stay home. I think so in some cases. You know, some people, they don't want to miss a day at work, so they come to work and they're sneezing all over the place and touching a copier.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that this, in terms of public health practices and protocols, we should maintain some of these practices moving forward.
Especially during flu season.
Yeah,
keep
agree
us safe.
Too.
All right, major change in subject here because this just broke from the Supreme Court as of 10:07 this morning. The Supreme Court dismissed a challenge to the Affordable Care Act on Thursday in a decision that will leave the law intact and save health care for millions of Americans. The justices turned away a challenge from Republican-led states and the former Trump administration, who urged the justices to block the entire law. The justices said that the challengers of the 2010 law did not have the legal right to bring the case. This was just released, so we don't have much detail as far as the vote and the actual.
But it is it's a great rulings. Victory for John Roberts, who obviously is the one who brought them over the line in the first place. But when it comes to some of the other stuff, we'll have to see what that 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court holds up.
Well, doesn't this give you at least a reason for optimism that we're dealing with honest brokers?
No.
Doesn't.
No, not really. I think these are Trumpians, to be perfectly honest with you. And I think when you look at it...
Or at least three of them, right?
Yeah, there was a sense that this is... you have three, but you had a couple of real stinkers before that who were on the court already. I mean, Clarence Thomas and some of the others. I think that this gives them a certain amount of judicial legitimacy to say, see, we're really judges and we can call it as we see it. But when it comes down to the tough ones, the economic ones, I think you're going to see that 63 majority hold up.
So I would say in sum,
the decision was
7-2.
Alito and Gorsuch dissented.
Oh, not Thomas.
Nope.
No. Alito and Gorsuch.
So in essence, I think it's we can count it as a victory for many people, however, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, what was left of the Swiss cheese Affordable Care Act, right, remains. Right. Mm-hmm. So at least that, we have a sense that there is a base insurance and health protection act in place. And now we, of course, need to see how we can remain or create some kind of a system that holds together.
With a 7-2 decision, which I would say is a fairly strong endorsement of this, would that in any way, shape, or form allow there to be a political climate to enforce and to fill in said Swiss cheese holes?
No. I don't think so. I mean, I think
those who are going to be against it are going to be against it.
Yes, yes. And I think that this just reminds us, for those of us who are for the ACA, we cannot fall asleep behind the wheel. Republicans are relentless. They have been trying to kill the ACA since the beginning. And so this is just another reminder that we still have so much more work to do to protect it. I doubt that this will be the last attempt to try to kill it.
And you know what, Dorsey, you make a very good point. What about universal health care is on everybody's to-do list. If you think long-term and long-range here, we'll keep this thing, which, as Vera says, is a Swiss cheese law now, rather than create the impetus for doing universal health care. So that may be much on the minds of some of these people when they think this thing through.
I mean, the other thing, this is what, the third case that's been brought on the ACA and Obamacare, mm-hmm. and the third time that the court has backed it. So, all right, let's go. Well, we have... Go ahead.
Well, only that we see a newly comprised Supreme Court, and that's why this is such an important decision. You know what I'm saying?
Well, right, but I'm saying, but three times.
Yeah. I know.
And it's passed all three tests.
And remember, when Roberts became the deciding vote the first time, so and that court has changed substantially since then. In which it has a lot of people thinking that Roberts does not have the power that he once had there.
Well, I'm you know, we've only learned about this 5 minutes ago, so I haven't had a great deal of time to think about it. But it just strikes me as important to the future of the court and what may be coming down from the court, that it was 7-2, and one of the two was not Thomas, who typically sides with Alito and negatively on everything, mm-hmm. but one of them was Gorsuch, who, in my mind, I saw as somebody who might be a swing vote on certain topics. Well, he was this time, but in a way that I wouldn't have
in the wrong direction
in this particular mm-hmm. case. But Thomas was on the other side this time, so I think that it's going to be rare that there's unanimity among the court. But it looks to me like there's some give and take depending on the topic. Now, I would still say the chances of if abortion ever comes up in the Supreme Court, and, you know, I'd be concerned, or those kinds of social issues, because sure. the 6-3 would be tough to impossible to overcome. But I do see some flexibility there with this Gorsuch vote in this case in the wrong direction.
And this interesting part of this case that. The Texas was, the lead state, and the other Republican-led states, as well as the two individuals who brought the case, they had no right to bring their lawsuit in federal court. Mm-hmm. So that's why it failed.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. I have a bunch of letters here on all kinds of issues. So let's talk about those, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Carol says, as a comment, so we don't spread concern regarding the length of the vaccine effectiveness, initially the Excelsior pass only lasted 6 months. They have had since updated the end date to 1 year from the date of vaccine. If you refresh your Excelsior pass, it will show an expiration date of 1 year.
Ah, it's good to know.
I hope that is true. Yeah. Not that I don't trust Carol, I do very much, but I don't know. I played around with mine. I haven't seen mine change, but hopefully it will.
Can anybody actually tell me if you have actively used your Excelsior Pass?
Oh, I have.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where'd you go?
Well, I was, I was when my wife was in the hospital,
right.
and I walked in and I gave them the pass and they scanned it the woman said to me, you just saved yourself 13 minutes of paperwork.
Huh. Oh,
I was
excellent.
Like, all right, well, that sounds good.
And in my state of Massachusetts, we just don't have it.
No.
Right.
And
no.
Now apparently that's what's supposed to, now when there were restrictions in place, and Dorsey, I don't know how Albany is working, but there were restrictions in place. You had to show it. I don't know. Is that all? Do we not have to do that anymore?
Well, I just heard last night that I'm sorry, you're asking Dorsey.
Yeah, I was asking Dorsey.
Yes. I heard that at stadiums now, you don't, Yankees and Mets, you don't have to show.
Don't have to show a proof, yeah. Dorsey?
Yeah, yep. And I was going to just add that, you know, a lot of this is being left to the discretion of the organizations or the businesses, how they want to handle asking for proof of vaccination. Some of the conversations that I've been a part of when it comes to things like public events, some talk about how it can be perceived discriminatory in nature to ask people for their vaccine status and proof, knowing that when you look at and populations, with even, for example, in the city of Albany, we have some zip codes where the vaccine rate is less than 60%, 50%. And so some people are a little more conscious of the fact that it can be discriminatory to ask for someone to present their vaccine card or status.
You know, my originally there were only three people allowed to attend my niece's graduation next week, and so that was mom, dad, and brother, and so we were going to watch it on a stream, and then we found out this morning that we can actually go to the ceremony. Aren't we lucky?
That's great.
You are lucky, Joe. I don't go to my own.
Isn't that great? We get to sit in uncomfortable chairs and listen to 500 names. Isn't that great news?
Is it Donahue is the last name?
No, it's Gannon, but it's it'll be fine. It's still up there. No,
I went to a graduation, and the person who was graduating, her last name began at Z.
Yeah, that's
so
a
that
long.
Was a problem.
Yeah, you know what? It'll be great to get out and see everybody, and it'll be fine.
It
I'm
will.
Looking forward to it.
But I wanted to make a quick comment on lower vaccination rates, right? I'm here working very regularly, almost every day, in West Hill. And
what is that?
West Hill is the neighborhood we're in.
Oh, okay.
That's called West Hill.
I knew Arbor Hill. I didn't know West Hill.
No, this
Hill.
Is West Hill.
This is West
you
Hill?
Are part, we
okay.
are part of West Hill, hey. And right, you know, a two-minute walk is where I work with the Refugee Welcome Center, a really great place. I have entire student teams there. And a shout out to pop-up vaccination sites, which we set up multiple times there, CDPHP, public health nurses, wonderful teams coming in, setting up for a couple of hours, and people get a chance to walk up for vaccinations. And every time we set one up, 20 people or so from the neighborhood walk up, and 3 weeks later they're coming back and they're getting their second shot.
Kudos to the people doing that work, because
I was
even at a convenience store down the street here and getting coffee, and there are people in there who are basically saying, well, look, we have the site, come on down. If you need transportation, we'll help you with transportation. We'll get you vaccinated. So that's all good news. Let's go to some letters. We have many, so I want to get to those before we end our segment for this half hour. Oliver says 95% is not 100%. The vaccines are not 100% effective. This means that you can still get COVID even though you have a vaccine. You don't need a mask if you're vaccinated is a dangerous oversimplification. You may be okay with the risks of being unmasked, but humans are notoriously bad at weighing risks when the numbers at either end of the percentage spectrum. Carol says,
fair enough.
As a comment, so we don't spread concern regarding the length of the vaccine effectiveness. Initially, the Excelsior Pass lasted only 6 months. They have since updated the... Oh, I read that, didn't I? I apologize.
Good one.
Okay. Maureen says, why can't we relish this decision for a few seconds before you comment? That on affordable care. Well, we don't want to.
Oh, come on.
It's a good thing. Yeah,
that's not what this panel
does. Let's have fireworks. We'll celebrate.
That's not what this panel does.
So we want to celebrate the fact that we're out and about and that we don't have to be as paranoid about, you know, getting sick, but we should always be alert.
Yeah. Well, Joe started the whole program about getting fixed.
Maureen,
bring the tea bags. Maureen says, why can't we rally? Oh, I read that. I got to delete these things. Randy says, Alan has been crowing about those help wanted signs in Great Barrington for years, well before the pandemic. Why should things be any different now? Is that true? I don't remember that.
No, I don't think it is true.
All
but
right.
I do know that I've been talking about it ever since the pandemic, and there isn't a door in Great Barrington that I've passed by that doesn't have a help wanted sign on it.
Randy goes on and says, besides, lots of people lost lucrative jobs and career paths due to the pandemic. Why shouldn't they properly use the unemployment insurance purchased to hold them over until they can find suitable work? It's taking longer now than times when there wasn't a pandemic that collapsed the economy. Why should these people rush to take low-paying, no benefit, no future jobs they never wanted?
Fair enough. Just to quote the great Selma Kaplan, just saying.
Wasn't the quote that I thought you were going to use from Selma, but that's all right.
That's my favorite, but I can't use that here.
Joanne says, with regard to the fireworks, it was my understanding that they were a thank you to all the first line workers who had persevered from the beginning of the COVID till this time, in which we reached herd immunity. I don't recall hearing that they were to celebrate the end of COVID, and in fact, mask wearing for children in school K through 12 was reinforced. Well, I think it was. They said that it was to celebrate that. I think both things are true. It was to celebrate that the ease of the restrictions, because we reached 70%, was the reason for the celebration. And then they were to honor those who were on the front line. So I think both things are true. And that is from looking at the governor's press release just a second ago.
And Ira, wasn't it you who said that it may be that there was a certain amount of deflection from Cuomo by putting the fireworks up? We're not reading stories about how his family is raising money for the guys who are in jail.
It's far from me. Far be it from me to be cynical, but that certainly crosses my mind.
Ira, that's why we have you on this show.
Playing the role of our cynic.
Don't disappoint us now.
I'm still sad because my Lone Ranger joke fell flat.
Diane says, as of yesterday, I received updates from Boston NOR. Anybody know what that is? NOR? Please don't use these abbreviations. I don't know what it is. NOR, that at least 10,000 people have gotten breakthrough breakthrough COVID positive. Some, at least 300 people, were hospitalized from these cases. We are not safe as yet. These breakthrough cases are from the latest variant. So, yes. Mm-hmm. And what we keep hearing about this also is that if you do get it, you do not get as sick and the symptoms are very mild, but you still test positive
right.
for
the
COVID.
The pressure on the healthcare industry in general is significantly less. You're not good.
And yet, 365 people or something like that are dying every day.
If a jetliner
goes down with 365 people on it, you're going to be hearing about it and in the investigations for many weeks. Yeah. So now we're in a different kind of position in which we say, well, isn't this great? We only have 365 or whatever it is.
Well, we no longer have refrigerator trucks sitting in the streets filled with dead bodies in them.
At least not in this country.
Dorsey, anything else?
Put another way, what about?
The only thing I'll add is that, you know, people have to make decisions that are comfortable for them. Everybody's body reacts differently, and so while we like to put out messages that, you know, if you're vaccinated, then if you are exposed to COVID, then your symptoms, you know, you may not be hospitalized, et cetera, but the reality is everybody's body reacts differently, so you have to make decisions. So, for example, the conversation about should I wear a mask even if I'm vaccinated. Personally, as Vera mentioned, I am vaccinated, but I still wear my mask in certain places. That's just my own comfort level. In addition, I have a 2-year-old at home who can't get vaccinated.
Right.
And so I try to be very mindful of not just my own health, but the health of my family as well.
Right.
Randy writes us and says, as a primary care provider, I will say we have no flu this year because very few were testing for it. All resources went to testing for the most deadly virus. There could have been plenty of flu, but we weren't testing it.
I'm trusting the public health people and the docs.
Also, life on this side of the pandemic, not that it is over, is not the same. Folks get a peek at what life is all about, family, love, fulfillment. People are getting way more creative to have the life they want now. Employers are going to have to provide far more to get workers in this current market. Time is much more expensive now. Will this last? We shall see. Go to Gene, who says, listening to these youngsters discussing the kind of job they want and the like-minded people to work with is ludicrous. You change the world by working with diverse minds. They seem to want segregation. Ooh. Desi says, the pandemic held up a mirror to each individual on their family, work, and cultural dynamics. Some said, I don't love the job I have. I need to find a place in work and personal life that I'm proud of. Some said they want to be masters of their own destiny and not just go where the wind takes them, just like after the world wars. Americans are reevaluating their priorities, and this is a good thing. We'll pause there. We have to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
can't help but wonder where I'm bound.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. We have a lot of letters I want to finish up.
I just want to mention that I love Tom Paxton, who you just heard.
Yes.
And who one night was staying with us and knocked on the door, and he had a big bottle of scotch with him.
Oh, yeah.
You think that's important?
I think it was for Tom Paxton.
Yeah. He shared.
Oh, good. Excellent. Did you partake, Alan?
I did not.
All right.
But you skipped over the most important part of the story. What was he doing at your house?
Well, he was playing at the Guthrie Center, and we have a little guest cottage. And he was staying there. That was something.
Oh, that's
we do
very nice. How did
was.
They hook you up? The Guthrie
yeah,
Center.
Well, we do that for
yeah,
them.
Yeah, that's
yes.
great. And yeah, I've seen that cottage. It's very nice.
Yeah, and there he was, and we had a friend staying over in our house with us, a woman I've known all my life, and she said, well, let's invite him over here, and I said, I'm not going to bother him, and there was a knock on the door, and there he was with his scotch.
Very nice.
That's good.
All right, let's. I want to finish up on letters here, if that's okay with everybody, just because
no.
we get so many. And
I want to tell another story.
All right.
What?
Tell me your story, Al.
Joan Baez brought crackers. Another Joe writes, the anti-vaxxers keep saying the vaccines are not 100% effective. Are the vaccines for anything 100% effective? I don't think so, but I'm not an authority.
Well, that's absolutely
believe you're correct.
Correct.
I don't think
never,
anything is. Even
never.
Ivory soap yeah. is 99.9%
I mean,
pure.
That's as effective as we have ever seen is in the 90s, right? Yeah.
So that's good.
Then we go to this letter from Desi. The pandemic held up a mirror to each individual and their family and work dynamics, and I've already read that letter, so I'll go to this letter from Robin. Alan, you clearly do not have school-age children. It is a big challenge for parents to go back to work as normal, even with schools open. Schools have shortened hours, aftercare is very limited, and your child can be sent home for any symptom and has to await a COVID test before reentering.
Damn good point.
Also, classes can be quarantined for up to 14 days at a time. Parents really can't hold down a job with these factors at play. And it'll be interesting to see how those factors change over the summer
yes,
months
right.
going in into the fall,
that's
given the lift of restrictions.
That's right. Good letter.
God forbid if we return to any concerns. Where we have restrictions back. Kate says, my grandkids go in-person school part-time 1 week in the morning, the next week in the afternoon. Hard to find a job with those kinds of crazy hours. Emma says, dear panel, have you not seen the data? So many daycare centers closed during COVID and have not reopened. This has impacted the ability of women in particular to re-enter the job market. All right. I think that is it for the main letters that I have before me. Let's go to this story, which I think is interesting. The Justice Department Attorney General Merrick Garland reversed on Wednesday Trump-era immigration rulings that had made it all but impossible for people to seek asylum in the United States over credible fears of domestic abuse or gang violence, marking one of the Justice Department's most significant breaks with the previous administration. His decisions came in closely watched cases where his predecessors, the former Attorneys General Jeff Sessions and William Barr, broke with precedent to overturn decisions by immigration appeals judges that would have allowed such asylum claims. The decisions, applicable to all cases in the system, including appeals, will affect tens of thousands of migrants, hundreds of thousands of Central Americans fleeing gang extortion and recruitment, and women fleeing domestic abuse have arrived in the United States since 2013. It will also affect many cases that are still being adjudicated, given an enormous backlog in immigration courts.
And that is a good thing this was overturned. We have enormous numbers of people fleeing domestic violence, gender-based violence, gang violence. And the idea alone that people could not apply for asylum under those conditions or at least get a hearing about their cases was pretty shocking.
Mm.
And as somebody who has on occasion be an expert witness for Central Americans in asylum court, I can tell you I have read the written up accounts. I've spoken with people who survived some of this violence, and I just think it behooves all of us to look at the details of each person's experiences and not dismiss their accounts and experiences, especially if they're children, especially if they're women or non-binary community members. I think this is an extremely sensitive issue, and we should be just and fair and stand up for basic human rights.
But you know, our new attorney general is under a certain amount of criticism for not acting quicker to reverse some of the Trumpian bar edicts. And here comes, right after he was deluged with that criticism, comes this overturning. I thought that was interesting.
Well, that timing, I don't know that there's a connection, because he couldn't have just decided, awakened yesterday and decided to do it. But I think it's the right decision, the correct decision. This is a country is accepts people who are in this kind of dire strait. And I think it's sad that what is inevitably going to happen is that if there's just one of them that has somehow comes to this country and commits a crime, and he or she will become the poster person for the far right to once again demonize immigrants. And
Ira, that's easy for you to say.
It's
easy for you to say because, you're a newspaper guy and sports and then regular editing. But I've been around politicians for a long time, and I know that they are perfectly capable of getting in a room and seeing that they're being heavily criticized for something and a decision that may have been on the books coming for a while, all of a sudden gets done fast, and say, we'll have some of that.
Are you talking about the garlic?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'll defer to your expertise.
And, as you damn well should.
Yes. And if you promise not to mention sports anymore. I don't do sports anymore for quite a number of years.
Well, you know how I feel that sports is the opiate of the proletariat. Yes. So.
And I did talk about sports on the media project today.
So what was it like? You go ahead, please, Doris. Yes, please. Please save us.
You know, I live in a very refugee-rich community, and I am always happy to see when people, neighbors in my neighborhood are able to thrive here in America, escaping some very difficult and traumatic experiences. So I, too, was really happy with this decision. I think America should continue to be that place, even though we struggle with our own internal issues of this whole notion of sanctity of life and human rights. I think as an overall tone that we should be setting is we are here to be a safe haven for those escaping and running from some very difficult circumstances.
Now, not to give you a hard time, Dorsey, but my question to you, because it's one we're all struggling with,
have a minute, but go ahead.
Is there a limit on how many people should be allowed into the country?
A limit? Is there a number?
Yeah.
Annually?
No, I mean free access. There are those people. I mean, Trump obviously was disgraceful in saying basically he didn't want anybody in. And now you got Biden who has to decide, does anybody who comes to that border get into this country?
No. We have very clear numbers set.
Go ahead, Mayor.
Well, Dorsey, I don't want to interrupt you.
Well, okay. I have to interrupt everybody.
Sorry.
Okay, we're out of time.
Really? Can I have like 30 seconds? 62,500 refugees can enter the United States for the rest of this year, which is not a lot. In the capital region, we will welcome about 500 people by the end of this year. 500 refugees will come and be resettled in the capital district. That is my comment.
Okay. My thanks to everybody. Dorsey, thank you very much. Very nice
thank
to have you. I appreciate you being on the line. And Alan, always good. Thank you for being
fun.
Here. Yeah, we had fun today. Ira,
nice
good luck in your
you.
Next venture.
Yes, Trader Joe's here I come.
And Vera, always good to see you. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.